It's great to be back at Queen's. I've been to a few of these over the years, I think, and I was trying to think of some of them, and I think the last one I was at was probably, I'm going to make you feel extremely old, about 12 years ago. So it made me feel old anyway. So as John says, this is a project sponsored by the ASRC called Visible Divinity. It has a Twitter account, as you can see. Is this a Twitter audience? If you don't already follow me on Twitter, or follow this account on Twitter, please do. I've just tweeted something about the Bishop of Limerick, who suggested that people might have to pay in to see the Pope when he visits in Croke Park this year. So it's topical, and also lots of pictures of churches that I drag my partner into on our travels, and the coin boxes mainly, and I'll show you some coin boxes later on. But this project really is about the relationship between religion and economics, and that's not necessarily an original theme. Lots of people have looked at that kind of thing in the past, but they've done it in two different ways, really. First of all, we obviously know Max Weber's Protestant Ethic and R.H. Tony's examination of religion's role in the rise of capitalism. Two of them were prominent of numerous efforts to gauge the influence of religious thought on economic activity. As many have discovered, however, attempting to match interpretation of scripture or transmissions of doctrine with transactions in the marketplace is no easy task. Meanwhile, the often vast amounts of money given over to churches by their laity has been treated as more or less a separate topic, often merely as an element in the church's internal politics, and in the Catholic Church's case, frequently as a corrupting element of its internal politics. As numerous salacious accounts by... numerous salacious accounts by journalists on the American Catholic Church and the Vatican in particular tend to show. There's a few examples here from dating back to the 60s with Worldly Goods. The one that's off to the side is more scholarly book. I wouldn't claim that to be salacious in any way. So these two strands of scholarship could be summarised as, on the one hand, the sacred facilitating the profane, scripture shaping capitalist activity. On the other, the profane tainting the sacred, money debasing religious institutions. But what I'm trying to do in my ESRC project is to take a combined approach that treats these two issues as inextricably linked. I suggest that studies that try to measure religious influence on economic activity and economic lives tend to ignore one rather important fact, which is that the main economic exchange within a religious setting has never been a primarily intellectual one. It's been a material one, a physical one, a handing over of cash. So if you want to gauge the influence of people's faith, their church, their clergy, on their economic lives, we can, of course, read social teaching, read the sermons and the pastorals and the instructional literature, but we don't know if they were listened to, read, acted upon necessarily. And my contention with this project is that the practical, financial and economic interaction of clergy and laity is far more likely to contain the real influence of the church on the wider economic culture. It also has a distinct benefit of being much more traceable, distinct benefit from my point of view, much more traceable, but not perhaps as traceable as you would like in terms of access to archives. So I think it's worth starting by putting the Catholic Church and its development in the late 19th, early 20th century into some context. A few of you might be in need of this, maybe not. So there were key circumstances in late 19th century Ireland that heavily influenced my argument. The first thing to note about the church in this period is that it was in something of a period of growth and renewal. As Emmett Larkin has shown, the kind of fortress Catholicism that many people associated with Ireland until relatively recently wasn't a centuries-long tradition. And in fact, as work by a variety of scholars, including Sean Connolly of this parish, pun intended, and David Miller has shown, before the Great Famine, Ireland was a country whose Catholicism was not in doubt, but whose practice of Catholicism could be intermittent, unorthodox and conditional. Figures for mass attendance in the 1830s famously suggest only up to 40% of those required to go to Sunday Mass weekly actually did so, far from the rate recorded as late as the 1970s. The key period, as many scholars agree, in this transformation was the third quarter of the 19th century, when what Larkin has termed a devotional revolution took place. There's obviously been a lot of debate about why this came about, this revolution. Some say Catholicism replaced the Irish language as a mark of Irish identity. Some that the virtual wiping out of a vast underclass of less practicing people by the famine simply allowed the values of a Catholic middle class, which had long been orthodox in its practice, to prevail. Whether the people proposing these positions stated plainly or not, these explanations boil down to Durkheimian versus Weberian views of religion. One interprets religion as something that lends meaning in people's lives. The other sees religion as a reflection of shifting societal power structures. Lawrence Taylor, the anthropologist who's looked at Catholicism in 20th century Donegal, says, like every undergraduate essay, it's a bit of both, it can be a bit of both, and I tend to agree with them on this. And the example of church buildings shows what I mean. So in the century after Catholic emancipation in 1829, 3,000 churches, 24 cathedrals were built on the island, and a pre-famine and post-famine comparison between the two shows the real difference in style that pertained in those churches. So the second of these buildings is enormous, seeks to dominate the landscape in the village it's situated in, elaborate in its design, has multiple opportunities within it for patrons to stamp their names in the pews and the statues and the stained glass windows and so on. So it's a place of worship and spiritual refuge, of course, and I think we shouldn't lose sight of that, but it's also undoubtedly a multi-layered statement aimed at people both inside and outside. To non-Catholics, it proclaims both a reinvigorated Catholic group identity and a sense of this being the church of the majority. But Catholics inside the building get the same message, but their engagement with the interior means they equally pick up on the power dynamics within their congregation. Who gets to sit where, who has their financial contribution inscribed in the building, and so on. So I show you these really because statements like this were not cheap. And along with the rest of the extensive infrastructure of Catholic Ireland, some examples here, many of them, certainly the more elaborate versions of them, were constructed in the post-1850, pre-1921 period, which is the focus of my project. And they were largely funded by, if not quite the pennies of the poor, then certainly the offerings of the laity from the pennies right up into to much larger amounts. Most of the plant of the church was built with money raised among Irish Catholics at home and also crucially abroad. The extensive emigration of the 19th century had produced a large and still connected diaspora, particularly in North America and Britain, whose encounters with industrial capitalism and wage labour made them far more cash rich than many in the still largely agricultural society they left behind. The Irish Church chased their resources accordingly, and they really did chase their resources, both directly from migrants themselves and indirectly from the families at home to whom they sent remittances. Almost all funding for capital projects like these were voluntary, in the sense that the laity could choose whether or not to contribute. The day-to-day maintenance of personnel and parish through various means, which I'll go into, was also a more or less voluntary arrangement with the laity, certainly in the sense that there was no tithe, there was no sort of legally enforceable method of extracting money from the laity. How much money is a big question that I might answer, we'll see. Certainly I told the ESRC that I would try, and I am trying. But some indicative figures can certainly give you an impression. So this compares a cathedral built in the 1820s and 30s in Tuam, which cost £20,000, and then one at the end of the century, which cost £300,000. You know, inflation over that period doesn't account for the difference, and when you see the figures translated into 21st century terms, you can see that. Really, the vague answer to my question, and also just point out as well that there's an increasing personnel as well in this period, as some of these numbers show you. That personnel obviously means more money needs to be raised to pay for them, but it also means that there are more people to raise that money from a shrinking laity. So the vague answer to the question of how much money at this stage is a lot, and I can go no further than that, but I hope I can go further than that later. But there was a seeming paradox here, which by the early 20th century travellers to Ireland remarked upon constantly. On one hand, what they seemed to see around them was abject poverty and a failing economy. On the other, obviously expensive churches. And travellers explained these with this paradox with varying levels of sympathy towards people's faith. But you can see in the language here, all implied that the Grand Church was a drain on resources responsible for the hovels that they contrastingly described. And I've highlighted in red here some of the language used in these quotations. Very similar, and you can see the influence of Horace Plunkett's Ireland in the New Century on them. Plunkett had written controversially and famously of excessive and extravagant church building in the heart and at the expense of poor communities, an example of priests' misdirected zeal. Now, notwithstanding Plunkett's closer observation of Ireland, these travellers were really simply repeating what he had said, and the reality that they were confronting was much more complex than perhaps they perceived. It's certainly true that throughout the period Ireland was economically underdeveloped, but while the economy remained overwhelmingly agricultural, it did undergo considerable modernisation. Catholic wealth did remain concentrated in the hands of a middle class of strong farmers and merchants and so on. But even the rural Catholic labouring and small farmer classes were adapting to involvement in a cash economy from which they'd long been isolated, fuelled in part by emigrant remittances. This famous, probably apocryphal, certainly unverifiable idea that in 1870 a third of all the cash in circulation in Ireland came from servant girls, Irish servant girls in America. That's probably not true. I think we can probably say that, but that somebody could make the claim, I think, shows you how important remittances were. So what we had in the late 19th and early 20th century was an Irish economy that was underdeveloped but slowly modernising, and to which an increasing proportion of the population now had a cash link. In short, the economy was changing, and at the same time, the church was vastly increasing and diversifying its fundraising. Just as many Irish people at home and abroad had more cash, the church was finding new ways to ask for it and new ways to spend it. So in that context, I think to see church fundraising as an isolated or esoteric or niche pursuit is hardly sustainable. I think it was widespread, it was a part of everyday life for many people, and central to how the newly cash-holding, if not in all cases cash-rich laity, came to understand money and their economic lives. So I should note some of my influences here. This is the economic sociologist Viviana Zellerzer's work on the social meaning of money. I'm using, in part, her concept of earmarking, which is the idea that money is not a single impersonal instrument which rationalises or even taints human interaction. Rather, she says it's something shaped by and incorporated into social relationships in multiple different ways. She argues that in our everyday lives we invent multiple socially meaningful currencies to perform different functions. And you have a list there of the different types. I've highlighted where church donations are classed by Zellerzer. She says they're a function of establishing or managing group identity primarily. Now, I don't disagree with that. I think that's part of it. But I also think it's important to note that the Catholic Church wasn't a monolith, and its constituent personnel and institutions asked for and received money in many different ways and in many different contexts. So Zellerzer's classification, complicated though it is, probably needs to be complicated further if we're talking about religious monies. There are multiple religious currencies, in other words, multiple ways in which money given to the church might be earmarked and differentiated. And as promised, here's an example. If you walk into any church, you'll see a raft of these coin boxes, which are, you know, for holy souls or the poor or electric lighting, things like that. Lots of different opportunities to give. There's no logical reason why you would give somebody an opportunity to give to one of these and not others in many ways, unless on some level they're understanding this need for people to earmark their donations. So one other related point worth noting, the further into the project I get, the more I'm beginning to also to think that the church's pursuit of funds and the records it's left behind, which I've accessed a lot of them, that they are a way for us to uncover the activities and the agency of the people who gave the money. Many have left no other trace on the historical record or present in the account books and other financial papers of the church. And I think that matters because, as Seth Colvin, the historian, has recently noted, we often think, being romantic historians, we think of non-elite agency as being anti-hegemonic. It's always against consensus. Colvin's example, it's a very appropriate one for the moment, is that we always remember the striking worker rather than the non-striking worker because they leave more of a record. and they are, for want of a better word, sexier. And I think that's true. Those who conformed or went with consensus that's in society are almost assumed not to have exercised agency because we don't hear their voices so clearly in the historical record. But while the work of Cara Delay and Eugene Hines, for example, has been excellent in finding the voices of some of those who fought against priestly power or who refused to pay the priest, I'd argue that paying the priest could be a form of agency too, and that the accounts of the church, the literal accounts of the church, can be read as records of a more compliant non-elite agency, if we can call it that. So those are some of the ideas behind the project. The main one is that the material relationship between priests and people is worth looking at because it, for its own sake, but also because it contains within it clues to the developing economic culture of Catholic Ireland at this crucial period of modernisation. I'm at the stage in the project where a lot of the archival research has been done. There was a research associate on the project up until recently. A lot of the archives are not necessarily very well digested by me yet, though, but I am forming some plans. I eventually will write a book on this, and it will be after 2020 for obvious reasons. And one idea is to concentrate some of the later chapters in around certain themes and particular economic concepts or processes that were inherent to the income generating activities that the church engaged in. These are three that I've come up with. I'll concentrate more on the third here, on the idea of matters of exchange or transactions, I suppose. I can say a bit about speculation and gambling and a bit less on debt, but I'll go through them in order. So one of the most important new forms of fundraising that the church began to exploit in its quest to build this big new infrastructure that we've seen it did, was a form of gambling. Many parishes and religious houses expanded their income through frequent use of lotteries, raffles and prize draws. The tickets here on the slide are just a few examples of what's likely to have been millions produced and sold across the island and beyond as well. Lotteries were an eminently practical form of fundraising for the church. They attracted the participation of the wealthy, who very often gave the prizes and bought tickets, as well as the less well-off who were able to buy tickets because the ticket prices were generally quite low. And they were an effective means of reaching the diaspora. Bundles of tickets were routinely posted abroad, and you can see here on this slide some evidence that shows that. So although these two yellow lottery tickets look the same, or look very different rather, they actually are for the same draw on the same date from the same order of nuns in Granard in County Longford. And the second one, it's a bit blurry, but the second one you can see has the amount, the ticket price and the prize amounts in dollars. The top one has it in, so clearly aimed at the US audience, and the top one has it in pounds, so aimed at Irish but also British audiences. This poster I came across in a couple of summers ago in Bally James Duff in County Cavan, of all places, where my mother went to school, and this was in fact hanging in her school, which is now the Cavan County Museum. And this is the first time I saw. So everything's in pounds until you get to the ticket price, where it says 25 cents each. So again, nuns in Bally James Duff with a global financial ambition. Lotteries were very popular, and in fact there was hardly a Catholic building in Ireland that wasn't in part constructed using lottery money in this period. I've said the practical reasons why they were used and why they were important. The fact that they were illegal as far as the British state was concerned, and the fact that many evangelical and Reformation societies in Scotland and so on railed against them and called them immoral and so on, that really only encouraged them, it has to be said, and they seemed to proliferate even more because of that. So this was an everyday process heavy with the potential to convey quite nuanced economic messages to participating Catholics. It, above all, communicated the relatively relaxed Catholic teaching on matters of speculation and gambling to a mass audience in a way that was intensely practical and far more effective than any article, pamphlet or occasional sermon may have been. So these are a couple of later mid-20th century Catholic Truth Society pamphlets on gambling. There's a reference to an article there in the Irish Ecclesiastical Record earlier in the 20th century as well. But people already knew what the church thought about gambling, because the church was, you know, encouraging it, in fact selling them tickets for lotteries. Debt then, it's also, this is something I haven't worked on quite as much. I can answer more questions about the lotteries afterwards if you have them. But sort of on the margins of going through the material, it's apparent that a very complicated set of ideas, maybe even mixed messages about credit and debt, was conveyed in the church's fundraising. Numerous fundraising efforts in the period referred to the need to clear the debt on the church building. And there was a need, because it couldn't be consecrated and you know, put into full use without the debt being cleared on it. But what that suggested was that many priests built first with the aid of bank loans and fundraised later on the basis of the debt being a burden that had to be cleared. But equally, you come across references in fundraising material, in newspapers and so on, to the deservingness of some priests in their fundraising campaigns on the basis of they're never going into debt to build their churches. You know, they wait and they fundraise and they build it bit by bit. So in both contexts, debt is seen as an evil, and it's conveyed as an evil to the lay Catholics who are the target of this fundraising. But its necessity is disputed, its necessity for progress is disputed. So I think there's potential in exploring this further. But I won't go on to that just yet. I will move on to the idea of transaction or exchange. Possibly the most obvious and significant part of the income generation of the church, a simple matter of exchange of lay money for clerical services. And it seems like a simple concept. The laity give money, the clergy dispense their religious rights in return. But even for similar services, the precise form of such exchanges varied immensely, both regionally and over time. And perceptions on either side of those transactions could also vary hugely, as I'll show. So even the most basic religious services could carry a charge. For Mass, some priests operated a pew rent or charged a sum at the door for entering the church. So, you know, charging to see the Pope in Croke Park is not, you know, beyond the capacity of the church. More often, each family in a parish was asked to pay a certain sum each Easter and Christmas by way of dues for the priest's everyday services. And separately, of course, the priest's celebration of sacraments, including baptisms, marriages and funerals, all had a price, sometimes in this period fixed by the diocesan bishop. In all of these cases, some very poor parishioners might be expected to pay little or nothing, and some more well-off might be expected to pay much more than the amount set. This arrangement of dues and fees could be seen as a form of progressive taxation on the faithful, from each according to their means, etc. But it was also in part the legacy of a much longer lay clerical dispute over such charges. Often seen as excessive before the famine, the priest's fees could sometimes be challenged, like the tithe and excessive rents, on moral economic grounds by agrarian secret societies, forcing most bishops and clergy by the later 19th century to charge only what their laity was prepared to bear when it came to dispensing the rituals of the faith. But evidence of colourful altered denunciations in my period suggests that even after those kinds of reckonings had occurred, lay and clerical expectations of financial exchanges didn't always match up. So the French politician and journalist Pascal Grousset visited Ireland in the 1880s, and he described the kind of haranguing that congregations could be subjected to. Daniel McCarthy, 4 shillings and sixpence, says the priest. That's not much for a farmer who keeps 3 cows and sold 2 calves this year. I'll hope for him that he only meant that as a preliminary gift. Simon Redmond, 7 shillings and sixpence. He might have given 10 shillings as he did last year. He's not what we'd call a progressive man. Harriet O'Connor, 1 shilling and ninepence. I'll be bound she like buying a new bonnet better than doing her duty. It's between her and her conscience, but I'm afraid at the day of judgment she won't find it such a good investment. So these
was that a sermon, wasn't it?
Allegedly, as reported secondhand by a French journalist. But I mean, I could find you numerous other examples of that. The Farm by Locker, that Mary Fogarty memoir, has a similar kind of comical kind of haranguing by the priest on this grounds. So these kinds of pronouncements have often been seen, I think, quite simplistically as you know, pure evidence of the social pressure that drove lay giving to the church. A superficial reading of this kind of speech can lead to assumptions about coercion and social capital being the only motives for lay giving. In these interpretations, the laity, relatively poor though they might have been, handed over cash to the church in such vast and ever-increasing amounts because A, priests publicly shamed or compelled them to, and or B, it brought them some facet of social status or respectability. Now, I'm not denying that these explanations obviously hold some water, but I think the problem with them is that they wrench agency from those who gave the cash and divorce the economic interaction from its religious context. They also assume that all parties to these monetary exchanges were on the same page as to their meaning. But I think if you dig deeper, you find individual agency and too often overlooked genuine faith were also very strong factors in the laity's financial generosity toward the church, and that they often saw their contributions and donations in quite different terms, even from the clergy who directly received those contributions. So I'm going to spend the rest of the paper talking about some examples that show this, really. And just to cheer you up on a rainy Belfast evening, I'm going to centre them around the many financial transactions around death. But they were very varied, surprisingly numerous, and I think their competing meanings are ripe for unpicking, which is why I'm focusing on them. So I'm going to look first at funeral dues, briefly then at bequests, or really the pursuit of bequests, which is something that Emmett Larkin talked about particularly, and then I'm going to look at mass intentions in wills as well. So first, funeral dues. So according to some critical authors, especially visitors to Ireland, funerals saw an unseemly form of dues payment to priests. As the nationalist politician Frankie O'Donnell described in 1910, quote, at a funeral in a congested district, the pecuniary collection extorted by the churchmen from the friends of the deceased on the coffin lid amounted to £193. The use of the term extorted and the scare quotes, which you can't see obviously, but the scare quotes around coffin lid indicate what may have been something of an exaggeration that nonetheless conveyed to readers the supposed moral dubiousness of this practice of laying money on the coffin. This trope was echoed by Patrick McGill in his novel The Rat Pit. The notion that priests demanded offerings be placed on the very coffin of the deceased and that they, as McGill's fictional cleric does, rush through funeral rites to get to the point where the silver is laid over the corpse was obviously a gift to those who wished to display the priest as a money grubber without decorum. But in fact, as other accounts of these kinds of funeral offerings show, the surface onto which the plate for offerings was placed might just as easily have been an ordinary table inside the altar rails. Attendees at the funeral mass made their contributions one by one, beginning with the closest relatives and working outwards. According to one Clogher diocese priest who was familiar with the routine, the priest, standing at the table, announces the name of the donor and the amount paid, with set expectations of appropriate amounts depending on the closeness of one's relationship to the deceased. A final total would also be announced. The origins of this practice is in dispute, and it's not very clear, but by one account it went back to the famine when, in the 1840s, as a partial reimbursement by the congregation for occasions when individual priests might have paid for funerals. I think a more plausible origin story dates it to the penal law period when priests were living a twilight existence and this was their main source of income. And others said it was as old as Christianity itself, which might be pushing it a bit. But whatever the case, by the 19th century it was a custom that was most closely associated with the Diocese of Armagh, mainly in Ulster. A few pockets of the Midlands and also Galway, as Frankie O'Donnell's testimony attests, also retained it. The Clogher priest was clear that where funeral offerings were in operation, no separate funeral fees were charged to the family, and the offerings tended to form the larger part of a priest's overall income. So other sources of clerical revenue, other charges to the laity would be lower as a result. That caveat surely wouldn't have dissuaded anti-clerical writers from critiquing what they regarded as a primitive practice, but there were criticisms of its use even within the Catholic Church from sympathetic commentators and parishioners. Pádraic Colum, the poet, noted that the practice was galling to many families, presumably because of the social feeling that entered into the amounts offered. As Colum explained, after a funeral, offerings could be employed as a monetary gauge of the deceased person's popularity and respectability. Quote, not much was thought of her, the priest didn't get a pound in offerings at her burial. He was a respected man, there was £10 in offerings. Funeral offerings, publicly declared as they were, came to be regarded then as a measure of the esteem in which the dead person was held by her family, friends and wider community, even though the money went directly to the priest. But the different views of priests and people on this matter were made clear in one indicative case that arose right at the end of my period in 1921, which was after the codification of canon law, which occurred in 1917-18. Before that, canon law was kind of all over the place. But this anonymous Ulster priest wrote to the Irish Ecclesiastical Records Notes and Queries column, and he complained that canon law, as now written, deprived him of the funeral dues of one parishioner who had died in another parish at the end of a 7 month stay in hospital. The priest of the quasi-domicile parish, the parish where the hospital was now indecently, in that priest's view, entitled to all of the funeral offerings, even though he didn't attend to the deceased throughout their life, nor conduct the funeral even. So he got all the offerings. And the Irish Ecclesiastical Record was unsympathetic to the claim that this thwarted the intentions of the parishioners who contributed the dues. Quote, "From all the inquiries which you've made on this matter," the response article explained, "we understand that the only express intention which most of the contributors have is to show respect to the deceased and to the friends of the deceased. Paying offerings is practically equivalent to attendance at the funeral." So in other words, the amount of the offerings was nothing to do with the priest or the esteem in which the congregations held him, even if priests like to think it was and believe that to be the case. Another case where lay and clerical perceptions of particular financial transactions differed, Edward Larkin, in his one of those three kind of articles that appeared in the American Historical Review in the 60s and 70s, he rightly noted that legacies and bequests formed an important part of the church's income, and highlighted the case of the elderly Hamill sisters of Belfast, two spinsters who in 1906 found themselves with £100,000 worth of assets at their disposal, no family to bequeath it to, and an evidently strong Catholic faith. They were, Larkin notes, the subject of competing charm offences from various clergymen, both regular and secular, in subsequent years. Yet, unseemly though the wrangling among priests for the Hamill sisters' attention surely was, I think Larkin misses a key point about the women's own conduct in this matter. So he's getting the story from the Bishop of Down and Connor, who's writing to someone in Rome about it, and he's one of the would-be legatees. He wants their money, in other words. And the sisters secured, through the Bishop of Down and Connor's efforts, a personal dispensation from the Pope, which allowed Mass to be said in their domestic oratory. But after that, to the Bishop's evident disappointment, they threw him over in favour of other religious suitors and presumably leveraged further favours from them. So this idea of the creeping priest at the deathbed of spinsters, of rich spinsters, is a very... popular trope of anti-clerical and anti-Catholic literature in this period, especially in the work of Michael McCarthy, for example. But the power in such transactions wasn't all on the church's side. The Hamill sisters and others considerably less wealthy could use the attention from clergy to their own ends, and the clergy eager to secure an income could find themselves beholden to their wishes. I think this becomes even clearer when you look at the religious provisions that actually made it into individual Catholics' wills. Even for those without the Hamill sisters' resources, bequests which set aside an amount of money to pay for masses to be dedicated to the repose of one's soul were within reach. Indeed, the dead, regardless of their level of wealth in life, had a surprising degree of power over the clergy when it came to such clauses. And that's in part because mass intentions were deemed a special form of payment by both laity and clergy, so earmarked by both, but in different ways. So for the layperson making their will, they were, in a sense, the ultimate form of pennies to heaven, a way to make one's entry from purgatory into heaven faster by having one's priest and one's fellow parishioners pray for one's soul. This is an example here from the will, or the probate record of Terence O'Hanlon, who was a hotelier in Belfast. And he had ambitions to leave money to have regular masses said for his own soul and the souls of all my ancestors and relatives, both by affinity and consanguinity, who have died in the Roman Catholic faith, going back to the fourth generation, especially for my own soul, and next the souls of my father and mother, grandfathers and grandmothers. I like that the grandmothers come last for some reason there. But we might also say that doesn't really imply a lot of faith in the speed of the process of getting out of purgatory. In any case, he didn't leave enough money, it seems, in his will. He had great ambitions for all of this stuff, but it's not clear that any of those masses were actually said because he didn't leave enough money. But so priests wouldn't have disagreed with Terence O'Hanlon this giving this money. The mass intentions worked in this way, and that the money they received would help the testator's path to heaven. But the money that the clergy received from this source was also special in a different way for them. Principally, these payments formed an important part of an individual priest's private income, as financial records from parishes show. So this is just an example here to show you, you know, how they were thought of. In 1892, the Archbishop of Dublin, Archbishop Walsh at this stage, ordered Father Nicholas Walsh to work out the financial viability of a parish, St Agatha's. The church was in a lot of debt, and he wanted to know, you know, what resources were there to dissolve that debt. And in you know, going through all of these accounts, Father Walsh refused to incorporate the money that the parish priest and curates in the parish received for mass intentions, telling the Archbishop that itemised funds didn't include the dead list of £40, which they divide equally and which I do not think is fair to take into calculation in the payment of the debt. So the priests, in other words, were deemed by widespread custom to be entitled to this money, to the money from mass intentions, as part of their discretionary private income, as part of their pocket money, in essence. And that disparity in earmarking of such cash between the parties to the exchange made the trade in mass intentions a fraught one. Because for all that the dead list was personal income for a cleric, the very strict stipulations of canon law on the matter meant that the wishes of the faithful who left the money had to be diligently carried out. This created an obligation for priests and made a great claim on a priest's time and resources, as he was limited to the performance of one such mass per day. In essence, then, wills formed a type of contract in which the testator employed the priest from beyond the grave. For example, Anne Carraher of Dundalk left £50 to her Father Harbison, and she requested, as a matter of conscience but not of legal obligation, that Father Harbison will expend said sum in masses for the repose of my soul. So this idea of conscience is there, but then it's also clarified in canon law that this is how priests must treat mass intentions. Moreover, while the practice of mass payments represented a type of commodification of religious services, the price these commodities commanded proved far from obvious. In very many wills, the precise number of masses to be offered for the sum of money left was not detailed. So, for example, William Coogan of Drogheda left £200 to Archbishop Dixon of Armagh, and he asked the Sisters of Charity spend it on poor relief, and in return that they pray to the Almighty for the salvation of my soul. But he doesn't say how long for or how many masses they should do for that £200. Other testators could be more precise with their claim. Anthony Cassidy, a Dublin merchant, left a very large sum of £785 along with his interest in some stock options to St Patrick's College in Maynooth, and he said the money should be applied to fund the education of student priests, and he said that all the students who benefited from this gift would have to say two masses every year for the repose of his soul. So he's sort of making a bargain here with priests who are not even ordained, let alone trained yet. And there's no time limit on this. So there could still well be priests out there trained in saying masses for Anthony Cassidy's soul. So as testators left money for mass intentions, it wasn't always clear what they received. How many masses did their money purchase? For what length of time would masses be offered in their memory? In some cases, perpetual masses were agreed. Bishop James Walsh of Kildare and Loughlin agreed to allow a priest in Clane Parish to perform or to allow a perpetual mass for the souls of Michael and Mary Ann Dunn on the first Monday of every month forever. Be interesting to know if that's still going on. Bishop Walsh allowed this because the Duns had donated a relatively small sum of £100 to build Clane Church. But perpetual masses started to become a bit problematic, and requests for perpetual mass intentions proved common, but they were increasingly viewed with disapproval. So in 1891, Mrs. O'Hagan in Dublin paid for masses to be said for her and her late husband, Judge O'Hagan's souls after her death, when she made a gift of £2,700 for the chapel at Milltown Park. But the Jesuits said no. The Reverend Father General could not consent to a perpetual mass because it was too much of a commitment, even for £2,700. So £100 could buy you mass in perpetuity in Clane, but not in Dublin a few years later. So it's possible on occasion to discern a clear market value attached to masses. These prices seem to reflect local custom and show some change over time. So, for example, the most common price paid for masses to the Capuchins in County Kilkenny in the 1860s was somewhere between 2 shillings and 2 shillings and 6 pence. In Limerick in the 1880s, a priest received a £10 bequest, which worked out at 5 shillings per mass, as specified. But the value of masses could oscillate wildly. In 1915, a priest in Queen's County, or rather a testator in Queen's County, left £300 to one priest and £100 each to two other priests. And he said he was valuing each mass to be said for him at a pound per mass. So, you know, it was wildly varying. Most mass requests were neither so clear nor so generous, however, and they could cause genuine irritation to the priests who were obliged to fulfil them. One priest, a Father O'Donnell from Limerick Diocese, expressed his confusion and annoyance to his bishop in one case in 1917. I've seen by the Munster News, he wrote, that a sum of £100 has been left to me for masses by the late Mr. Power. I've not yet got this money and perhaps may not get it for months, nor have I heard how many masses are to be said, but I suppose they will be at the rate of 5 shillings each, although I'm told his offering during life was only 2 and 6. I cannot complain of want of intentions here, as latterly I've had to give away over £20 for masses every year. It looks a big thing, but between Sunday, retrenched holidays and corpse masses, for many of which no offering is given, there are really only from 3 to 4 days in the week free for other intentions. Consequently, should I get the bequest of £100, I cannot put more than about £10 of it into my own pocket. Latterly I have a difficulty in getting priests to accept intentions, as those I offer them are only at the rate of 2 and 6. So I think this is worth unpacking. The priest was given a legacy for saying masses, which he only found out about in the newspaper. He didn't know about it beforehand. He was likely to be unable to have the time to say most of the masses that the money was left for, and therefore couldn't keep the vast majority of the money himself. And yet he'd have difficulty giving them to other priests to perform as well. But under canon law, he was still obliged to ensure that these masses were said. So the legacy turned out, you know, from the outside, it looks like, oh, he's getting £100. What a nice bequest. It actually turns into a sort of financial burden and an administrative headache for him. So the trade in mass intentions, I think, is an interesting case study of divergent meanings attached to the same monetary exchange by those on either end of the bargain. The money behind a mass intention was special, in Viviana Zelizer's terms, for both priests and people. From the layperson's point of view, it was kind of an entrance fee to heaven, and from the priest's perspective, it was his personal pocket money. But again, much of the agency in the exchange fell on the side of the testator, and even if many of my examples have dealt with relatively large sums of money, the same obligations on priests were in operation regardless of the amount of money involved. So I'll conclude. It's a given, of course, that if there was, you know, I started by talking about the messages that might have been conveyed from clergy to laity about money, that Catholic, in the process of Catholic fundraising and income generating. And I think it's a given that the overriding message about money that the Catholic Church gave out can be summarised in 4 words, and that is, give it to us. But context is everything, and Ireland in the late 19th century was a place whose people were becoming more intensely Catholic at the same time as far more of them were getting more access to cash rather than a mere subsistence economy. These processes were interlinked. The Church's renewed and relentless emphasis on raising money meant that the most powerful and far-reaching messages it gave out about economic behaviour were not conveyed abstractly through what its clergy said, but were conveyed actively through what its clergy did. But as I've shown, I think, we can't simply assume that the messages were received and acted upon in the way that those sending them intended. Once transmitted, there was space for individuals and communities to respond to those messages in often very different ways, to shape what was considered a socially appropriate response at a local level, to earmark money given over for particular services, and even to provide responses that fundamentally inconvenienced or annoyed their clergy. So I think broad brush intimations of a monolithic, all-powerful church that financially gouged the laity with threats to their social and celestial standing may have been the default position of contemporary critics, but I would suggest that they're not a useful way for historians to conceive of the monetary or indeed other relationship between priests and people. Lay people had agency in that relationship with their clergy. If the pulpit pronouncements of some clergy conveyed the idea that proper economic behaviour had a religious reward, it needs to be made clear that the laity had a stronger say in what constituted proper economic behaviour than some reading those statements have given credit for. Arguably, in the process of fundraising and income generating, the laity, especially but not exclusively the better off, could recognise their own agency as consumers of church services. The repeatedly stated importance of the monetary relationship between priest and people may have had may have, on one hand, made the laity value clerical services more highly. They literally bought into the priest's spiritual authority and mediated their faith and their church membership through the handing over of cash. But it also lent the laity an authority of their own, because they were constantly reminded, if you don't keep giving us money, this whole, you know, edifice is in danger of collapsing. And that's a message that I think gets through. So the economic interactions of priests and people in 19th century Ireland, it's my niche concern, but I don't hope it's not too niche a concern. And I think numerous and frequent and varied as those interactions were, I think these interactions have a lot to tell us about economic life, about conceptions of money, and about the agency of the people who were giving the money. So I'll leave it there. I hope you have some questions for me.